going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
The founder of Panasonic once said,
"We can lead more meaningful and constructive lives
through the pursuit of activities that will ensure
a better today than yesterday,
a better tomorrow than today."
Panasonic is committed to creating a greener,
more equitable future
for everyone.
Explore Panasonic Green Impact
at na.panasonic.com/greenimpact.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. NATO, or the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, turns 70 years old this week. And to mark the occasion, its Secretary General will go to the White House and will speak before a joint session of Congress. So NATO is 70, as we said. The Cold War has officially been over for 28 of those years. And my guest this hour says it's high time that Europe looked after its own defense, that NATO has accomplished its founding goals and exhausted its importance to the United States. And he says the U.S. should radically rethink its role in the transatlantic alliance. So this hour on Point, do we still need NATO? And you can join us. What do you think? Beyond the is Europe pulling its weight question, does the U.S. really need NATO anymore? Does it enable American militarism and European passivity? Or with Russia projecting its power, is NATO actually more important than ever? What is the true best purpose today for how America should view this alliance? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Well, joining me in the studio today is Barry Posen. He's director of the Security Studies Program at MIT and author of Restraint, A New Foundation for U.S. Grand Strategy. His recent column in the New York Times was headlined, "Trump Aside, What's the U.S. Role in NATO?" And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Barry Posen, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Let me start off with a line that you wrote in your New York Times piece. You write that NATO's founding mission has been achieved and replaced with unsuccessful misadventures. I'd like to break that down a little bit. First of all, tell us about why you think NATO's founding mission has been achieved.
Well, when NATO was founded, the basic problem was that the Soviet Union was far and away the greatest military power on the continent, and most of the countries in Western Europe had been weakened by war. The Germans had essentially started the war and not only been defeated but bombed into oblivion and divided in half. So Western Europe was vulnerable to potential Soviet aggression. And we didn't agree to defend Western Europe from the Soviet Union out of charity. We agreed to do it because we feared that weak and shattered the Western Europe was, if the Soviet Unions were to take it, it would be a net accretion to Soviet power of a scale that the United States would then have to adapt to address, and adapt quite seriously, right? So this was kind of a classical balance of power kind of strategy, the kind of strategy the British had practiced against Napoleon, for example. It made sense at the time, but the European economies have recovered. Germany is one of the most prosperous countries in the world. The Soviet Union has collapsed. Russia is a shadow of the Soviet Union in terms of military and economic power. So at this point, it looks like America's goals have been achieved and the Europeans should be more than capable of defending themselves against the residual threat that Russia might constitute.
Okay. So let's just get down to the bottom line here then, because you talk about a reappraisal of the U.S.'s role in NATO. I mean, are you going so far as to say that you think the U.S. should pull out of the alliance altogether?
Well, there's what I said in the op-ed and what I myself believe. My point in the op-ed is that simply having the 70-year celebration and assuming that everything is hunky-dory is a missed opportunity. There are clearly a lot of problems, and I think in my view, even many supporters of NATO would agree that there are a lot of problems. And this is an occasion to reconsider how the transatlantic security relationship should be organized in the future. I myself believe that the way it should be organized in the future is that the military aspects of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization should be ended. The United States and Europe can have some kind of political alliance if they wish. That was the original thought behind NATO, by the way. And we can use that as a vehicle to concert action at times and places where we think that our collective interests are engaged. But in terms of having this, you know, 60,000 American troops, a giant headquarters, American military commanders, all this joint planning, I think it's time for that to go. I think that that, in fact, demobilizes the Europeans from looking after themselves.
I mean, and people might point to the, what is it, the 1.25% that the Germans spend of their GDP on military spending versus the 2% that NATO would ask? Is that an example you'd point to?
Well, that's an example of demobilization,
right?
The Germans at one time had one of the most powerful militaries in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I mean, people just have erased this from their memories. By the end of the Cold War, the Germans were spending 3% of GDP on defense. They could put 1 million soldiers in the field in something like 4 or 5 days. They had 5,000 tanks and 12 or more armored divisions. It was an extremely powerful military. To call it a shadow of its former self is basically impolite to shadows. The military is in parlous shape, and the Germans spend, compared even to many of their NATO partners, a very small share of their GDP on defense. They could easily spend more. They choose not to do so, in part because our guarantees are so extravagant.
Okay, so, but you say in your op-ed here that on the point of Germany spending 1.25% of its GDP, let me just read a little bit more of what you write. On this point, you say, until 1990, the German army could put 12 heavily armed divisions into the field a few days after mobilization. Today, it would be lucky to get 1 fully equipped division onto the field. Less than half of German military equipment is ready for combat. So I guess what I'm saying is this, to me, that makes it seem like Europe, or at least the sort of the heavyweight powers in Europe, perhaps aren't as able to quickly and readily defend themselves as we might think or might want them to be. And so therefore, the existence of NATO or the continued existence of NATO should be justified.
The continued existence of NATO is what allows them to be as weak as they are, right? I mean, you know, one needs to be a little bit practical about how one discusses implementation. I believe the Europeans need to understand that the Americans are moving in a very different direction and that they have some number of years to adapt, and we have to credibly commit to that different direction. The Germans need to be given some time to tune themselves up. Now, how much time would that take, right? People forget that in World War II, we were able to mobilize whole industrial economies for war in 30 months, right? So it can't be that it takes 10 or 20 years, not for one of the most advanced industrial powers in the world.
Hmm. Yeah. So the second half of that sentence that I started the conversation with, I want to hear more from you about. You talk about misadventures, in your words, that NATO has undertaken in the recent past. What are some of those misadventures?
Well, one of the misadventures that NATO undertook was the expansion to include all these new countries in Eastern Europe. Those countries got themselves out of the Warsaw Pact, or in the case of the Baltic states, got themselves out of the Soviet Union, and that was great. And from my point of view, all of those countries should have emulated Sweden or Finland. They should all have become armed neutrals. I think NATO made an egregious error, both in political and military terms, by bringing all those countries into NATO. In political terms, moving the NATO's frontier, and NATO is a military alliance, closer to Russia, was a way of saying, we win, you lose, get over it. You might be next, right? Now, that doesn't mean that was what we actually believed.
But it certainly got the Russians' hackles up.
It certainly got the Russian hackles up. And second of all, you know, we took on new military missions that are much more difficult than the old one, right? I don't know of any planner who thinks that the actual physical defense of the three Baltic states is actually a practical matter. And that's not because we spend too little, right, or because anybody spends too little, which we do or which the Europeans do, but simply because the geography is so unfavorable to the defense of those three little countries. It's just a very, very hard thing to do. So NATO, in a fit of absent-mindedness, took on a whole lot of obligations. So that's one misadventure. A second misadventure is the wars, right? Now, we can argue about the individual reasons for Bosnia, for Kosovo, for Libya, but you add them all up, they're not conspicuous successes. They weren't particularly necessary for American national security. They became necessary in order to prove that, especially in the Balkan cases, that NATO had a purpose or NATO had a mission, right? But as actual security threats, these weren't security threats. And the Libyan war was actually quite inimical to our interests and ultimately to Europe's interests because we knocked over the regime. Nobody was willing to put in peacekeeping forces, opened up the arsenals of Libya, and those weapons are now loose all over Africa.
But I have to ask you about Bosnia in particular because, you know, there are some analysts who'd say that part of what led to the Bosnian genocide was a failure of U.S. leadership upon the breakup of Yugoslavia. And then eventually when the United States and NATO decided to step in, it was the thing that was required to end a genocide. It may not have been in the strict definition of the national security interests of the United States, but it was in the security and life and death interests of millions of Bosnians. And why not have an alliance, a military alliance vis-a-vis NATO, be deployed to protect not only the people, but certain values as well? I mean, the whole protection of liberal democracies we'll get to in a minute.
If you want to relitigate Bosnia, we can relitigate Bosnia. But I think if you look carefully at the history of the Bosnian War, there were many off-ramps in the Bosnian War before we got to the large-scale killings of in Srebrenica that came at the end. And the United States was not helpful in finding an end to the Bosnian War for many years, right? The Europeans had some very interesting ideas about how to end that war, and I think they would have ended it had we not been in the way, right? So our involvement in that project was not an unalloyed benefit. Now, in the larger sense, right, if people who support the alliance do want to add these other purposes, and they want to say that NATO's purpose is humanitarian intervention or stabilizing the periphery or building democracies hither and thither. The problem with this is that these are not the real reasons why we joined the alliance, and B, we're not that expert in doing many of these things. Right? I mean, many of the countries whose democratic virtues were extolled or predicted to grow after they joined the North Atlantic Treaty Organization are going sideways now. NATO was not really a good vehicle for this.
Well, Barry Posen, director of the Security Studies Program at MIT and author of a recent column in the New York Times questioning the U.S.'s role in NATO, stand by here for just a second. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Listen closely. As a master painter carefully brushes Benjamin Moore Regal Select down the seam of the wall. It's like poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. NATO turns 70 this month. And this hour, we're talking with Barry Posen. He's the director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. And he wrote a recent column in the New York Times headlined, Trump aside, what is the U.S. role in NATO? And he's asking the important question about whether or not the United States ought to rethink what its role is in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And of course, the president, President Donald Trump, has been very vocal about this. Here's what the president, or I should say then-candidate Trump, said in 2016 about his view of NATO. He was doing a phone interview with Jonathan Carl on ABC's This Week.
What I'm saying is NATO is obsolete. NATO is obsolete, and it's extremely expensive to the United States, disproportionately so. And we should readjust NATO. And it's going to have to be either readjusted to take care of terrorism, or we're going to have to set up a new coalition, a new group of countries to handle terrorism, because terrorism is out of control.
That was then candidate Donald Trump in 2016. On the other hand, we have a comment here from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg speaking with CNBC at the Munich Security Conference in February of this year. He says NATO remains relevant.
What we need is a strategy to deal with uncertainty, to be prepared for surprises because they will come. And one important element of such a strategy is to have strong international institutions, like, for instance, NATO.
That's the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Barry Posen, let me ask you, I mean, about this question of relevance versus the certainty that Stoltenberg says NATO provides. There are people who might...
Relevance is a low bar.
Well, but on that point, there are people who might hear your argument and say, actually... Vladimir Putin has proven that NATO has never been more relevant than it is today, because he's already showing his willingness to project Russian power, obviously, to your point, a shadow of Soviet power, but he's willing to project it in Ukraine, in Georgia. And not having NATO there or a strong NATO would only further embolden him.
I'm not going to say that Russia wouldn't think more carefully about coercing other countries or attacking them if those countries are in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the Americans are continuing their guarantees within the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I'm asking how much this matters to the United States as a national security matter. That's the question I'm asking. I'm asking what the cost-benefit calculation is for the United States in NATO. Now, the fact that the Russians have sharp elbows on their own periphery should not come as a surprise to anyone who studies great powers. We have sharp elbows on our periphery. The Chinese have sharp elbows on their periphery. In the absence of the United States as a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, I'm pretty sure the Europeans would find a way to concert action to deal with threats to the values that they care about, right, and to the countries that they care about, right? So how might security be reorganized in Europe? It's anybody's guess. The European Union is a liberal international institution. It's right there. They have solidarity guarantees to one another. They have nascent military command and cooperation structures. They have the money. They have the weapons factories. They have the GDP. They have the people. They have professional militaries. They have nuclear weapons. I don't really see why the Europeans who are, people don't know the facts. I mean, French and forget all the other members of the European Union. French and German gross domestic product is anywhere from 2 to 5 times that of Russia. 2 to 5 times, right? GDP is where you distill your military power. How can it be true that the French German dyad could not be competitive with Russia? How could this conceivably be true? It's actually the case, oddly enough, although the measurements may be squishy, that France and Germany together today probably outspend Russia on military power, right? So they're just the notion that the Europeans can't look after themselves, just it's an indefensible notion. Now, if you want to say that they won't, my answer is they won't so long as we do it for them.
Right. Well, but so you were saying that if you're looking at through the lens of a cost-benefit analysis to for American national security interests.
Correct, yes.
I was looking at sort of a response to your op-ed that was written by Hans Benenjik, and he wrote it in Defense One, and he said, okay, if you're going to look at it through a cost-benefit analysis lens, he says, think about it this way. The U.S. annual trade in goods and services with Europe exceeds $1 trillion. U.S. total direct investment in Europe nears $3 trillion. These economic ties enhance U.S. prosperity and provide American jobs, but they require, in his words, require the degree of security now provided by NATO to endure.
This is simply an absurd proposition.
Why?
Because countries invest in trade with each other all throughout history on a wide variety of alliance and institutional relationships, right? American and European businessmen trade with each other because it's good business. America and Europe trade with each other because it's good business. Now, if Hans wanted to argue that if there were pirates on the high seas, countries couldn't trade, I would say, yes, that's true, which is why when I talk about American military power, I like having a big navy. I think it's a good thing to have, right?
Yeah.
But so far as needing the North Atlantic Treaty Organization to support investment in trade, I just think it's an absurd proposition.
Okay, so what about this then? Who has invoked Article 5? Or when has NATO invoked Article 5? For the United States in response to 9/11 in the Afghan war. So if anyone is – if I'm looking for different lenses here to evaluate NATO's usefulness or benefit to the United States.
Look, I think it was a really wise and honorable thing for them to do. But you will remember that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld declined their direct military assistance for the initial operations in Afghanistan because he didn't think their forces were up to snuff. The European contributions to Afghanistan came later in terms of the counterinsurgency, peace enforcement, and we were darn glad to have them once we just changed our strategy or had this strategy of trying to pacify the whole country. But if you probe deeply into the European presence in Afghanistan, each country sent its forces under constraints that are called caveats in NATO parlance. So each country had special rules about the things its forces could do, the risk its forces could take. So this is a living example of my view that even within this liberal alliance, countries basically look out for their own national interests. And a contribution by one to the cause is not necessarily equal to a contribution by another to the cause. Now, I should say one other thing before I finish with that. Yeah. Many European soldiers died in Afghanistan, and I honor their service. I think they were heroic under bad circumstances, right? Because their own countries surrounded their behavior in Afghanistan with all kinds of odd political constraints.
But about this one-to-one or the contribution of one nation to a cause doesn't necessarily equal the contribution of another. Let me turn that on its head, Barry Posen, and just ask you, why should it? I mean, another way of looking at it is that the United States is the overwhelmingly dominant military power on the globe. It's the dominant, for now, economic power on the globe, that perhaps we could look at NATO as the vehicle by which the United States, you know, historically it's been called, shows its leadership on the global stage. Why isn't that a sort of an acceptable purpose or benefit that NATO brings to the U.S.?
Well, this gets back to the more fundamental questions of what you think U.S. grand strategy should be about, which I did discuss in the mm-hmm. book that you mentioned at the top of the hour, the restraint book. I have a particular view of what U.S. grand strategy should be about. And in the first, it should be about defending the safety, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of the United States. And to do that, we need a certain power position that allows us to do this. But America doesn't need power after power for its own sake. The United States doesn't need to be the liberal global hegemon. There's a wide variety of choices that we can make. And I think this particular choice has not worked out so well for us, not just in NATO, but in the Middle East as well. well, right? So when people tell me, but what about leadership? What about, you know, yeah. My attitude is, well, I mean, we need to reconsider, you know, all of this. And the more specific point I would say about military power, the United States is the greatest military power in the world, in part because of choice. Our European allies, who are equally rich, choose not to spend more on military power. The Japanese are equally culpable, right? They spend 1% of GDP on defense. At one time, we were worried about the Japanese economic challenge to the United States leadership. This was after the Cold War ended, right? They spend 1% of GDP on defense. They're not even striving for the NATO 2% goal, right? So it's not like given by the deity that the United States has to outspend the next 10 military powers in the world, or whatever the number is.
No, but
is
we
now.
Like to. No, I mean, we've been increasing our defense budgets of our own accord year after year.
Don't say it's for our own accord. It's not
of our own accord.
Yeah, but it's those arguments are always made on the basis of the defense obligations that we have assumed. Right, they're made in light of, oh, we need to do more to defend Japan. We need to do more to defend Europe. We need to do more to stabilize the Persian Gulf. It's always we need to do more. And Americans don't ask, well, is it possible that we need to do more because some of our friends aren't holding up their end? And that's the big reason. It should not be the case that the United States, which is one of the most inherently secure countries in the world, has to spend $700 billion a year on defense. It shouldn't be true.
Well, Barry Posen, hang on here for just a second, because you've given us a great deal to think about. And I want to get a response from Rachel Ellehus. She's joining us from Washington. She's Deputy Director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Rachel Ellehus, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Magna.
And thank you for your patience as well, because we had a lot to go through with Barry to let him lay out his thesis here on the relevance of NATO to the United States today. I mean, what's your first response to him? He's asking for a real rethink of America's role in this 70-year-old alliance now.
Well, so listening to the discussion with Barry, I was struck that I do agree with him on the need for more equitable burden sharing within the alliance and more balance of leadership between the Europeans and the United States. But a lot of the criticisms that he directed at NATO seem to be more criticisms of foreign policy and not necessarily faults of the alliance. Certainly, NATO has work to do, but it's clear to me that NATO has always been and continues to be in the U.S. national interest. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. First of all, we benefit from the stability that's in Europe. It is underpinned by NATO. The fact that the EU is our largest trading partner and investor, the fact that billions of Americans are working for European companies, the fact that U.S. and Europe make up a third of global GDP and set the rules of the game in trade and economics is because of a stable and prosperous Europe, which was enabled through the peace that NATO made possible. Secondly, U.S. power is not inherent. It is our allies that enable U.S. leadership. Our influence, our economic power, and our military strength are all enabled by this network of alliances and partners worldwide. The reason that we have outside influence and our views are listened to is because people know that the U.S. leads, but that there are a number of other powerful nations standing behind us. And then thirdly, on the assertion that allies do not really contribute to the security of the U.S., they are actually our biggest foreign and security partners on all the big issues of the future. So climate change, terrorism, mass migration. And just to make a point closer to home, in terms of homeland defense, the intelligence they provide, the radars they host, they're really our eyes and ears on the ground with regard to defending the United States. So if anything, NATO is more relevant than ever. And those who understand that NATO is greater than the sum of its individual parts understand why that needs to endure.
But Rachel, let me ask you, though, because Barry Posen has been making the point as well. And I'll let Barry respond to what you just said. But he in his op-ed, for example, he made the point that NATO, as it currently stands, the existence of NATO has allowed for misadventures, as he puts it, and that it's not even serving the original purpose anymore. There's no need for it for NATO as it is, given that the geopolitics has changed so dramatically in 70 years. I mean, he's issuing a fundamental critique of NATO as it stands today. Does he not make a good point there?
Well, certainly. But I think the argument is based on a bit of a narrow understanding of what NATO is. NATO is not just a military alliance with the single goal of stabilizing Europe. It's a political as well as a military alliance where nations can come together. They can consult on any security issues of concern. That's codified in Article 4 of the North Atlantic Treaty and became even more important during, for example, the Suez Crisis. So we use NATO in a political role as well for preventive diplomacy, information sharing, building consensus. I could easily see NATO be used for building consensus around China and what exactly their goals are with all the infrastructure and IP investments that they're making in Europe and the United States. The tasks of NATO are also not just collective defense, the so-called Article 5, where we defend the territory of the member states. We've got crisis management and cooperative security, which are aimed at preventing crisis. And in terms of misadventures, NATO operates by consensus. So we're not going anywhere without the agreement of the United States. And if I look back over the Balkans and Afghanistan and some of the things that have been characterized as misadventures, those were in fact led by the United States, pulling other allies along and convincing them to come alongside us. So we have not been pulled into any misadventure that we did not seek.
Mm. Well, Barry Posen, I'm going to give you a chance to respond here. Just FYI, we got a minute before we have to take a quick break, but go ahead.
Well, I'm glad we agree on one thing, which is there has to be more equitable burden sharing. The problem with that is that pretty much everyone has agreed on that for years, and almost nothing has been achieved, and almost nothing can be achieved so long as the United States offers such extravagant guarantees. You know, it's all good and well. It's just an easy thing to agree on, right? But it's a hard thing to implement. And so far, I think even partisans of the alliance have been pretty limited in their commitment to this.
Okay, so Barry Posen and Rachel Elihus, hang on here for just a second. We have a lot more to dig into when we come back. We are talking about NATO at 70. It's the 70th anniversary of this key alliance for the United States and whether or not it's relevant anymore. Barry Posen says no for the U.S. Rachel Elihus says yes. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Gold One knows that your skin changes all the time, like waking feeling hydrated, only to have dry skin after a walk on a cold day, or having dull skin at work, to glowing skin for date night. People don't have one skin, they have skins. And Gold Bond Lotion's clinically proven formulas contain 7 nourishing moisturizers, plus 3 vitamins to help you take care of all of them for all your skins. Gold Bond. Visit goldbond.com to learn more.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about NATO at 70. This month is the 70th anniversary of the key transatlantic alliance and whether or not it's a relevant alliance for the United States anymore. Barry Posen joins us today. He's director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. He wrote recently in the New York Times a column titled or headlined Trump Aside, What is the U.S. Role in NATO? We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Rachel Elihus also joins us. She's Deputy Director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Barry, let me just turn back to you here for a second, because I wanted to hear your response to something that Rachel was saying before the break about, you know, we might be focusing on the military alliance or the military aspect of this alliance, but that we have to recognize that NATO is as important a political alliance for the United States as anything. And what's your response to that?
Well, I guess my response is that when we have spirited conversations about NATO, it doesn't take very long to get to the Article 5 question, right? we have hung all these other bells and whistles on the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Some of them is what any large organization does. It infuses itself with value to make itself more legitimate. But the essential rock bottom reasons for the alliance are about our national security and the national security of the allies. That's the rock bottom foundation. And as long as you have that as the basis of your conversations about NATO, you can have a discussion that weighs benefits and costs. Once you start including infinitely expansible general terms such as stability, we can't really have a conversation, because how are we measuring stability? And how are we measuring the value of stability, since I'm not even sure I know what stability is, right? And you know, Rachel's observation, she talked about some matters of that type, but she also talked about some other more substantive matters such as intelligence. Mm. Now, Americans should understand that the United States spends enormous amounts of money on intelligence, absurd amounts of money on intelligence. We spend annually on intelligence more than any one of our NATO allies spends on its entire military effort, almost $80 billion a year on intelligence every year. Right. So the notion that we depend on our allies for intelligence is probably not the case. Is it helpful? It surely is. Right. Would there be intelligence cooperation in the absence of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization to deal with issues of mutual concern? Almost certainly.
So, Rachel, about that last thing that Barry Posen said, I mean, in the absence of NATO, isn't it entirely unrealistic to think that intelligence sharing would go down? Why do we need NATO for that?
No, I don't think intelligence sharing would go down. We certainly have multiple intelligence relationships across the world. I was just trying to make the point that some of the intelligence relationships which we have with select European countries are very unique. So we may spend a lot on intelligence, but we may not have the access. So if an adversary like Russia sees, an American UAV collecting in the Mediterranean, that's going to be a flag. Whereas if one of our allies who's more regularly flying around there for homeland defense purposes, that's not going to really raise eyebrows. So in terms of the North Sea, the Black Sea, the Mediterranean, it's about the access they have combined with that intelligence that really is value added. I'd also offer that it is a choice for the U.S. The U.S. could certainly depend more on allies and reduce its intelligence spending. But every time I've made that argument when I was working in the Pentagon previously, you know, we didn't use our allies quite enough to offset risk. And I think if we're looking to save costs and we're looking at return on investment, we can certainly leverage their capabilities even more than we already do.
Mm. Well, let me just go to some callers here because we have a lot of folks who want to just give us their view. So let's turn to Jim, who's calling from Kent, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air.
I accept that NATO originally was intended as a defensive alliance against Russia or against the Soviet Union. But it seems to me that the proof that it changed from a defensive to an offensive position was when the Warsaw Pact disbanded. We could have done the same. We could have just said, okay, the Cold War ends now. The Warsaw Pact is done. We're done. We could have just disbanded NATO and come home and saved a whole lot of money in the meantime. But the fact that we stayed, and not only just stayed, but expanded into former Soviet territory, that is proof in itself, I believe, that we are now on an offensive footing and that the rock-bottom foundation for NATO, its main purpose now, is to invade the Soviet Union, to take it over. We've become the Fourth Reich. We're doing exactly what Hitler did by taking Western Europe first, getting all the countries on board, and then invading the Soviet Union.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. Just a point of fact, the Soviet Union no longer exists, but thank you so much for your call. Rachel Elhus, let me just ask you about Jim's previous point about NATO becoming an offensive alliance rather than a defensive one. In a sense, I think that's sort of shades of what Barry was saying earlier when he looks at NATO's actions in Libya, for example. What do you think?
I think that NATO is still primarily a defensive alliance. And although we can look at the threat of the Soviet Union as it was, we still have a Russia that is revisionist. They are using not just the traditional conventional and nuclear means, but they're also using military means. So tools that are below the threshold of armed conflict. So disinformation, cyber attacks, you know, pinpointing critical infrastructure that they could hold at risk. Energy pressure. So while the threat may look different, it is still very present.
Let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Jerry, you're on the air.
Yes, a couple of comments. I spent 9.5 years as a NATO staff officer, both in Europe and also in the U.S. And I was in Europe during the end of the Cold War from 93 to 97. Also served in Bosnia for 6 months. We talk about the expansion and so forth. It wasn't that NATO pushed for these countries to join. Those countries were eagerly ready to join NATO because they saw the benefit of the alliance in protecting them from being pulled back under this, the Russian influence. Also, as far as the NATO cost to the U.S., if you look at what it costs between the military budgets and the infrastructure program, it's less than 0.1% of what the U.S. spends in the Department of Defense. So the access that we get from being members of NATO and part of the alliance far outweigh the cost. And that's my main main comments.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for your call. Barry Posen, would you like to respond to Jerry?
I totally agree with him that the countries that were formerly in the Warsaw Pact or in the Soviet Union eagerly sought membership in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization because they know their history and they knew that Russia wouldn't be flat on its back forever. And they were hoping to get a security guarantee that would last forever and would come from the outside. I don't doubt that that was their motivation. My question was it in our interest to provide that guarantee? That's my question, right? And I don't really think it was, because I don't think our strategic stakes were very high. Now, on the question of cost, when people start talking about NATO costs, things can become very slippery very fast, right? So what the caller referred to was a little bit of money that's spent on infrastructure and a little bit of and the money we spent for the few thousand troops the United States keeps in Europe proper. But this doesn't even begin to cover the dollar cost to the United States of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because as the caller I'm almost sure understands, when the Cold War ended, the American military turned itself into basically a vast strategic reserve to cover all of these bets. So we left forces and outposts all over the world, but we maintain most of our forces consolidated in North America, and those forces are meant to support any of these contingencies as they come up. Those forces, in my judgment, would not be as large as they are if it weren't for the various projects that we've taken on, and I've tried to assess what those numbers are, but it's always an argument. So partisans of any particular U.S. alliance, whether it's the NATO alliance or the Asia alliance, take the very tippy-toe part of the alliance, the American troops that are forward deployed, right, and they say that that's the cost of the commitment, but that is not the cost of the commitment. The cost of the commitment has to be assessed by looking at the magnitude of the American forces that we build to be able to make good on all these commitments.
Okay. But Rachel Elhus, let me turn back to you here. This conversation, I keep turning a question over and over in my head because it really depends on how you view it. I mean, it seems as if, and Barry, you can tell me I'm wrong about this, but that Barry's saying that NATO, the existence of NATO, has cost the United States more than it has benefited us. But I heard you say earlier that nothing's really happening, that NATO doesn't really do anything without U.S. leadership. So, I mean, is really the question not so much NATO, but how the United States has chosen to use NATO in its power projection, whether political or militaristic, around the world?
Absolutely, Meghna. If we look at U.S. defense spending, it's 3.5%. And people roll that figure out, but only a small percentage of that goes towards NATO and Europe. A lot of it is for our forces in the Pacific, our forces in the United States, and just a global power projection. In fact, I would argue that the United States forward basing in Europe reduces the costs because we have forces in Germany and Italy and the United Kingdom that are then moving further forward to AFRICOM, CENTCOM, Africa, Middle East, that actually saves costs. If every time there was a conflict the U.S. wanted to respond to and we had to deploy forces from the continental United States, it would be a lot more expensive than utilizing the forces we have in Japan or South Korea or Germany. So even if we look at it from a pure monetary cost perspective, there is a positive net, I would argue. But then again, let's take cost on a cost-benefit on a bigger calculation. Again, the point that I started off with was how much influence the U.S. has. When the U.S. puts its finger on the scale, allies follow. A good example of this is after Crimea in 2014, there was a lot of concern about Russia's behavior and whether they would continue on to the Baltic states. Well, NATO was a bit slow on the decision making, but the United States and a handful of other allies were first out of the gate in terms of presence. The point of NATO is not only defense, but it's also deterrence. Mm. So those types of early moves that are decisive and demonstrate resolve to an adversary and say, you made move one, but don't make move two. Those are the types of things that prevent wars, and that is why we need NATO and the consensus it brings and the forces forward. Yeah. A percentage of 3.5% seems to me a very small amount to pay for an insurance policy to keep that stability afloat.
Well, Rachel and Barry, hang on here for just a second. We've only got a couple minutes left in the show, and I do want to bring in one more voice just to give us a sense about what NATO itself is thinking moving forward. David Herzenhorn joins us. He's with us from Brussels, and he's chief Brussels correspondent for Politico. David, thank you so much for your patience in waiting here. And welcome back to the show. Let me just ask you quickly, I mean, this is the 70th anniversary of NATO this month, and there has been a lot of conversation within NATO member states themselves about how the alliance itself needs to be modernized. I mean, to Barry Posen's earlier point, do we have the same needs today as we did 70 years ago? So what is NATO saying about how it needs to change for the times?
Well, there's no question that NATO feels this pressure, as everyone does, to modernize for the age that we live in, including with a new initiative they've got called the 430s Initiative, where they want 30 land, air, and sea battalions to be able to be in motion within 30 days. But I think it's very important, Magna, to go back to a point that you were making. I want to take it a step further, because it's very misleading to suggest to listeners that NATO exists in any way separate and apart from the United States. It's not just about United States leadership. I mean, spend time at NATO headquarters, and you understand that NATO and the United States are inseparable. I mean, it reminds me of the suggestion of the leavers in Britain saying that the UK is separate and apart from the EU after 40 years, and that the EU isn't an extension of British government services, right? So there is nothing that NATO does that is not without U.S. impetus and the U.S. interest at the heart of that. So when you push on NATO allies, the European allies, and I spend a lot of my time asking them very tough questions about their military capabilities and why those fall short, you have to keep in mind that some of the most important shortfalls are by U.S. design. The fact that Europe does not have its own what they call C2 command and control capability, that's by U.S. demand and design. In other words, you can carry out an international military mission under the U.S. umbrella, or you can do it under the NATO umbrella, which, again, is the U.S., right? The Supreme Allied Commander is always an American. The Deputy Secretary General is an American. Nothing happens at that headquarters without the U.S., and we'll see it all on display in Washington in the next few days when you see the Secretary General with President Trump in front of Congress making clear who is the most important ally. But you have to keep in mind whether you agree or disagree, whether you criticize or don't criticize, these two things are inseparable. So it's American foreign and military policy that's being criticized here. And the Europeans who are asked to pony up, it's what are they being asked to spend money on? This is something Donald Trump hasn't understood, right? How NATO financing is calculated. Not on NATO's central budget, not on Jens Stoltenberg's salary. That's all paid per formula. Everybody's paying their share. It's a question on national military spending. So these countries are being asked to spend more on their own militaries, but essentially what? To buy tanks or weapons for an operation that will then be commanded and controlled by the United States. So you have to take responsibility before just saying, well, get out, unwind this alliance, which maybe over the long term is a good idea, and first understand how it got to where it is right, and why. Also important, the perspective from Moscow, where they would be very happy to see the U.S. pull back. Look at Syria. It's just the latest example of where Russia was able to assert itself on the international stage. The United States there, not acting under NATO's umbrella, seeding the way. I mean, some of the most powerful NATO allies looking at that and saying, wow, look at what Putin has showed that region, that, you know, Assad is still in power. And there is a question of, do you criticize U.S. military policy when it's independent of NATO or when it's independent of NATO and through NATO? But either way, it comes back to a criticism of how the U.S. has handled military policy over the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Well, you know, we just have 45 seconds left to go. This has been such a fascinating hour. Barry Posen, since you started by getting us thinking about this, I'm going to give you the last thought today. Is this really a matter of the question of American leadership, as David Herzenhorn is saying?
Oh, it very much is a matter of American leadership. The United States has, for its own reasons, squelched many European efforts to develop command capabilities of their own, right? So this is a two-sided thing. And I talk about NATO and this two-sided relationship again in my book, right? I think the Americans made a terrible, terrible error when they actually tried to convince Europeans not to organize their own command structure, right? So this point, I think, is well taken.
Well, Barry Posen, his book is Restraint, A New Foundation for U.S. Grand Strategy. And also he has this recent column in the New York Times about NATO. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Barry Posen and David Herzenhorn and Rachel Ellehus, thank you all so very much for joining us this hour. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.